Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we'll take you to Portland and the University of Southern Maine for a recent speech by former U.S. Senator George Mitchell. Mitchell's talk is entitled Understanding the Middle East and Its Significance on the World Stage. It was given at the annual Right Express Leadership and Creativity Series. Mitchell was special envoy for Middle East peace under President Barack Obama from 2009 to 2011. Mitchell is also joined by USM President and Middle East scholar Selma Botman for a Q&A session at the end of his speech. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Mike Dubiak, Chairman and CEO of Right Express.
Good evening. My name is Selma Botman. I'm the president of the University of Southern Maine, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you this evening to the second annual Right Express Creativity and Leadership event featuring Senator George Mitchell. USM is deeply grateful to Mike Dubiak, who is here with us tonight, and to Right Express for their support of this event, which not only enriches the university, but also the community as well. I'd like to thank all of you as well for coming this evening. I want you also to know that all of the ticket dollars will go to scholarships, will support scholarships at USM for our students. So thank you very much for your support of Thank you very much for your support of the jewels in the crown of USM. And now I'd like to invite Mike Dubiak up to the stage to offer a few remarks.
Well, welcome, everybody. It's great to have you here this evening. I call this a twofer. We had Senator Mitchell and Selma speaking this morning at a Right Express event in this same auditorium, and you're in for a great evening of insight into a very complex situation in not just Israel, but in the Middle East overall. So if anybody can give us insight, I think the senator can and Selma can, and I think you'll find that they don't always agree. So it's the way it should be. You'll get some perspective. It's not an easy thing to have your hands on all the right answers. But I would like to welcome everybody to our second annual Right Express Creativity and Leadership event. We hope this brings the community together for great insights into different aspects of what makes our lives and our culture so rich. So before I introduce the senator, let me just say he'll come up. He's the keynote speaker this evening and give you some of his insight. I'll then invite Selma up. She'll say a few words. The two of them will then take questions. We've gathered questions from some of you in the audience, and then hopefully also have time to open up questions for the audience as well. So a little background, and I had to reduce the resume because you can imagine with his distinguished career, the resume goes on and on. But he was born in Waterville, Maine, attended Bowdoin College. He gave us a story how he ended up in Bowdoin College this morning, and how that kind of really set the stage for him on how important education was. He attended Georgetown University's law school. He served as the U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from January 2009 to May 2011. Has a distinguished career as a United States Senator. Was appointed to the United States Senate in 1980 to complete the unexpired term of Senator Edmund Muskie, who resigned to become Secretary of State, as we know. Elected to a full term in the Senate in 1982 in a stunning come-from-behind victory, Senator Mitchell went on to an illustrious career in the Senate spanning 15 years. He's the former U.S. Senate Majority Leader, serving from 1989 to 1995. He served as a special advisor to President Clinton on Ireland in 1995. He served as the independent chairman of the Northern Ireland Peace Talks from 1996 to 2000, Under his leadership, the Good Friday Agreement, a historic accord ending decades of conflict, was agreed to by the governments of Ireland and the United Kingdom and the political parties of Northern Ireland. In 1999, Senator Mitchell wrote Making Peace, an account of his experience in Northern Ireland. In 2000 and 2001, at the request of President Clinton, Prime Minister Barak, and Chairman Arafat, Senator Mitchell served as chairman of an international fact-finding committee on violence in the Middle East. The committee's recommendations, widely known as the Mitchell Report, was endorsed by the Bush administration, the European Union, and by many other governments. Some of the awards and special recognition that he's received: in 2008, Time magazine named Senator Mitchell one of the 100 most influential persons in the world. He's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor given by the U.S. government. He's also received the UNESCO Peace Prize from the United Nations. He's also been a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. Of special note, for 6 consecutive years, he was voted the most respected member of the Senate by a bipartisan group of senior congressional aides. In 2006 and 2007, he led the investigation into the use of performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball. He's also the founder of the Mitchell Institute. The core mission of the Mitchell Institute is to increase the likelihood that young people from every community in Maine will aspire to, pursue, and achieve a college education. Each year, a Mitchell Scholarship is awarded to a graduating senior from every public high school in Maine who will be attending a 2- or 4-year post-secondary degree program. The Mitchell Scholarship Program has awarded nearly $8 million in financial assistance to nearly 1,800 Maine students since 1995. Wright Express is proud to be a major corporate donor of the Mitchell Institute for the last 3 years, and we're proud to make a contribution to the Mitchell Institute with respect to tonight's events as well. And as Selma said, all of the proceeds from the proceeds at the door will go to USM scholarships, which we're also proud of. So with that, I'll say no more. It's my honor to welcome Senator George Mitchell.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Mike, for that very generous introduction. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your warm reception. It is, of course, always a great pleasure to be home, and I do feel at home here, having lived in this area for so many years and having made so many friends, several of whom are here this evening. I am particularly honored to be on the program with Selma. Mike said you'd hear about the Middle East. I happen to have passed through the Middle East on a couple of occasions on assignment. Selma's career has been really studying and knowing the Middle East, so both you and I are in for a treat tonight. I'm able to keep quiet for a few minutes so that she can talk. She really is an expert, and she's doing a wonderful job at USM, and so it's a pleasure to be here at USM. Mike Dubiak and Wright Express have been, as he said, strong supporters of the scholarship program that I created when I left the Senate, which I will say to you, frankly, means more to me than anything in my life other than my family. And when Mike called me up and asked me to come to USM to speak, I said, "Mike, if you ask me to go to Timbuktu and speak, I'll go there also." So here I am for really one reason, and that's as a way of saying thank you to Mike Dubiak and Wright Express for their strong support for scholarships to Maine young people. Now, on to the Middle East. As I said, it's complex, it's difficult, it is a very long and tangled history, and no discussion of a few minutes can really delve into all the details. So, of necessity, What I will be able to say is to provide a general overview, and I hope some of the details can emerge in the discussion when Selma gets up here. With respect to the Arab Spring, I'll make 2 points. The first is that I think it is one of the most important events in the modern history of the Middle East. But it will take time for the result to become clear. Historically, revolutions don't settle into a final outcome for quite a period of time. Recall, if you will, our own revolution, in which we spent the immediate aftermath in the period of the Articles of Confederation, with 13 separate states, which didn't work. And it was only 7 years later, when a constitutional convention was held, and the obvious infirmities of the Confederation compelled the founders to create a national government. And that took a while to settle out. So you can say that even in our country, decade, 2 decades, before the results of the revolution really were clear. With respect to the Arab nations, there is a tendency on the part of many of us in our country to regard them as all the same. They're all Arabs. They're all Muslims. They're all the same. Well, they're not all Arabs. Turks aren't Arabs. Iranians aren't Arabs. And they're not all Muslims. And even those who are Muslims are deeply divided between various sects. So the first point to remember is they're different countries. They have different histories, different cultures, different political organizations, different clans and tribes and families, which are very important factors in the politics of the region. So, almost inevitably, the results will be different. There'll be results that we like in some places. There'll be results that we don't like in other places. We can influence them. We should encourage them in the search for democratic institutions and the kind of freedom and opportunity that we take for granted. But ultimately, they will decide their futures, not us, which is as it should be. Not many people here have recently read the Declaration of Independence. One of the interesting things I discovered traveling to the region is, at least the people I met, and I met obviously only a very tiny sliver in every society, are very familiar with the American Declaration of Independence and the concepts of our Constitution. They reaffirmed what I knew before, but what we all ought to remind ourselves of, that the United States was a great nation long before it was a great military or economic power. The greatness of the United States began from the beginning with the principles laid out in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, not easily summarized, but surely including the sovereignty of the people, the primacy of individual liberty, an independent judiciary, the rule of law applied equally to every member of society, including the government itself, and opportunity for every member of society. It is that to which many in the Arab Spring aspire, but not all. There are different visions, there are different objectives, and there will be periods of turmoil. So don't expect it to happen soon. Don't expect it to happen clearly. And don't expect it to happen the same way in every place. Paradoxically, with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Arab Spring has served as a new barrier. A conflict which has gone on for a long time and for which there are many reasons why it has not been solved, now has another one, and that is uncertainty, anxiety, to some extent, fear. Neither the Israelis nor the Palestinians know what the outcome is going to be. They both had as a central pillar of their policy in the region their relationship with the government of Egypt and specifically with President Mubarak, and they both were badly shaken with his departure. And so both are doing what human beings naturally do in times of turmoil and turbulence, and that is to step back, to wait, to see what happens before taking any huge risk. Israel has a state, a highly successful state. If any of you have not been there, I urge you to go. It is an impressive, emotional, really powerful statement of what men and women can do to build their own state. And it is a state to which the United States is fully committed that they should exist behind secure, defensible, and recognized borders. What they don't have is security. In recent years, the threat of suicide bombers. In prior years, the threat from foreign armies. In future years, the threat of rockets. So they want security, and they ought to have it. The Palestinians, by contrast, don't have a state. They want one. Independent, sovereign, democratic, viable. And they ought to have that. If we believe what we said, if we believe what we said in the Declaration of Independence of the right of people to govern themselves, the Palestinians ought to have the same right that we have, that the Israelis have, and that other peoples have. I believe that neither can attain its objective by denying to the other side its objective. Stated another way, the Palestinians are not going to get a state unless and until the people of Israel have a reasonable and sustainable sense of security. But I don't think the Israelis can get that security until the Palestinians get a state. And so they each ought to be vested not only in their objective, but in the objective of the other. Because that's the only way the mutual accommodation of their central objectives, that an agreement, which can only be arrived at through direct negotiations by the parties, with the active and sustained support of the United States and our other allies, that's the only way they're going to get it. Now, clearly, majorities in both societies, not everyone, but majorities, favor a negotiated agreement that results in two states. The problem is how to get there. The societies are deeply divided politically. It is not easy for a political leader in any circumstance, and particularly in what are life or death circumstances in both societies, to make what seem to be concessions unless there is an assurance of a reciprocal concession of equal importance. And the problem has been getting to that point. Despite an intense effort, we were not able to do that in the last couple of years. Although we were able to get them into negotiations, we couldn't sustain them. And now the administration is continuing the effort along with our allies in the so-called quartet, the U.S., the European Union, the U.N., and Russia, to try to create a framework within which the parties can come back to negotiations. I believe it's difficult to be optimistic in the short term, but I believe there's reason to hope that beyond the short term, they will realize that the pain of getting to an agreement, while significant on both sides, is less than the pain that they will endure if they don't enter into an agreement. There is, of course, first, the dreadful possibility of renewal of violence. That is something that we all hope and pray will not occur, But if the past is any guide, it is certainly a possibility, something to be avoided on both sides. It's been devastating for both, but particularly to the Palestinians. From the Israeli standpoint, there are several challenges, and I'll mention just a couple of them, that they face. The first is demographics. In the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, there are now about 5.75 million Jews. In the same area, there are about 5.25 million Arabs, if you include the 1.25 million Israeli Arabs, the Palestinians on the West Bank, and the Palestinians in Gaza. And every demographer with whom I consulted, and to the best of my knowledge, anyone in our government has consulted, many of them Israeli and Arab, agree that with a much higher birth rate overall on the Arab side, the majority will be Arab within a few years. The only difference the demographers have is when's it going to happen? 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 9 years. Very soon, not a long time, there will be a majority of Arabs. And if there is then no possibility of a two-state solution, Israel and its people will face the awful choice of having a state that is either Jewish or democratic, but will not be both. And that's a choice they should not be forced to make. And the way to avoid it is to have a two-state solution. Having it a Jewish state is important. After the history of the Jewish people, Israel represents more than a nation. It's an ideal, a realization, and something that all of us should endorse and support. But it can't happen and be a democratic state if there is no two-state solution and Jews are in the minority. The second threat, technology. After the rash of suicide bombings in previous decades, Israel built an enormous wall to separate themselves from the Palestinians to reduce the number of suicide bombings. It's worked. The number's way down. There are other factors. One is the very effective anti-terror effort on the West Bank by Palestinians. But I lived as a young man in the U.S. Army in Berlin, Germany. I then spent 5 years in Northern Ireland when I led the peace talks there. Both of them have walls. Walls do provide temporary respite, but they do not provide solution to the heart of the problem. And this wall in Israel will not either. And it doesn't even deal with the most serious threat, and that's rockets. We don't like to think of it, but much of the drive toward technological advancement in human history derives from war. And the fact is, it is an absolute iron law of history that weapons disseminate rapidly. And right now, the threat to Israel's existence comes less from suicide bombing or the possibility of some major Arab army with tanks crossing the border than it does from rockets. In Gaza, Hamas has 6,000 to 8,000, crude, not accurate. But if you're an Israeli living in a border town and a rocket drops on your head, it is no consolation that it was a crude, inaccurate missile that just happened to land on top of you. So the fear and anxiety is still high. Hezbollah has more than 30,000 rockets right on Israel's northern border, substantially more accurate, substantially more dangerous and destructive than the Hamas weapons. And then most dangerous of all, Iran now possesses missiles which can reach Israel when launched from Iran. So while Iran uses the proxy armies of Hezbollah and Hamas to get closer to Israel's border. They have the independent capacity to strike at Israel from Iran itself. And that's a very dangerous development, deeply threatening to Israel and alarming to all of the countries in the region. Most of the Gulf Arab countries, which are Sunni dominated, strongly fear and oppose Iran's expansion of influence into the region. A resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would help in permitting a regional alliance to secure the region against the advances, the attempted advances by Iran. The third threat that Israel faces is deepening isolation, and it is a very serious problem for Israel. It is now isolated around the world more so than at any time since its founding. Just in the last few weeks, Israel's previously good relationship with the two major powers in the region, Turkey and Egypt, have begun, in the case of Turkey, a sharp deterioration. In the case of Egypt, a possible threatening one, as the turmoil there leaves uncertain the status of the treaty between Egypt and Israel. The Egyptian military wants to keep it in place. The United States is working hard to keep it in place, but there's not much doubt that one of the consequences of the revolution in Egypt, which we support in the effort to achieve democracy and human rights for its citizens, nonetheless, we have to recognize that one of the consequences will be a policy which will be more attuned to public opinion, that's one of the results of democracy, than was the prior regime. In addition, around the world, Israel's support is declining rapidly, ironically just as it is increasing in the United States. It's very strong in the U.S., particularly in the Congress, and especially in the House of Representatives. But in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, it is declining sharply. In February, the Palestinians introduced a resolution on settlements to the UN Security Council. There are 15 members of the Security Council, 14 voted for it, only the United States voted against it. And of course, under the rules of the UN, the United States and the four other major powers have a veto, so we vetoed it. In addition to the Security Council members, according to many published reports at the time, a total of 135 countries in the United Nations supported the resolution. Only the United States opposed it. Palestinians have now introduced a resolution in the Security Council dealing with the issue of statehood. The United States is working hard to prevent that from passing. If it comes to a vote in the General Assembly, which is uncertain at this time, it will receive a decisive majority, although not 135-1. There will be many countries that support the United States in opposition to it, but it will be a decisive majority in support of the Palestinian position. It's an isolation that will have profound effects for years to come, and we, as Israel's strongest supporter, should be deeply concerned, and we are working hard to encourage actions and policies which will reverse that tide, that declining tide, and encourage greater support around the world. It's unhealthy for Israel, it's dangerous for Israel, and it's not good for us that their dependence now is almost entirely upon the United States. And we are working very hard. I spent, when I was the envoy, a substantial part of my time in Europe and meeting with Asian leaders, trying to maintain a united front with respect to our positions. So those are threats Israel faces if there is not a two-state solution. There are many others, but that's a summary of them. On the other side, for 60 years, Palestinians have lived under occupation. And those who don't live in the West Bank and Gaza live in very difficult conditions in camps in the surrounding countries. Three generations have lived in these circumstances where there isn't freedom to move. There are restrictions that we as Americans would find intolerable. In 1948, the United Nations offered a partition plan, roughly dividing the territory in half and making Jerusalem an independent city. Israel accepted the resolution. The Arabs rejected it. And the first of many wars began. Now, the Arabs believed that they would win easily and overwhelmingly in that first war. And certainly the numbers were on their side. There were only 600,000 Jews at that time in Israel. That was the community. There were tens of millions in the populations of the surrounding countries. But as we know, the Arabs were not coordinated, didn't work together, and Israel won the first of many wars, and now Israel has attained a military supremacy that is simply unchallengeable on the Arab side. There isn't a single Arab leader with whom I met who would not today gladly accept the partition plan that they all rejected 60 years ago. In the interim, there have been several other plans offered, all of which have been rejected. What is notable about them is that over time, the options available to the Palestinians have gotten fewer and less attractive because the circumstances have changed. And so, what I believe, and what I said directly to President Abbas and to Chairman Arafat when he was there, you've been waiting 60 years for the perfect solution to come. It isn't going to come. You're going to have to accept less than 100% of what you want. So you ought to make the best deal you can in direct negotiations with the Israelis, in which the United States will play an active and supporting role. Get a state and build a state. Do what the Israelis did. Build a successful state, and the Palestinians can do it. Despite the difficult circumstances they've been under for the past 60 years, they are remarkably educated, entrepreneurial, energetic. This is a country filled with immigrants. I told you my own immigrant story, and there are many children of immigrants here who I know. But you go around the country now and you find Palestinian Americans and you will find among the most successful people in our society. And they can do that if they will get into negotiations and stay in negotiations until they get an agreement. I believe they can and I believe they will. They haven't been willing to so far, but I think there will be a growing realization that the pain, the political pain of a negotiation, the political pain of accepting an agreement that is less than 100% of what you want is better than the alternative of the next 60 years in the same circumstance that they exist today, or perhaps worse. And I repeat, as I began this small section, the possibility of conflict must weigh heavily on these leaders, because they have a responsibility for their people, and the loss of life in a renewed round of conflict could dwarf that of the past. Now, the role of the United States is to pursue both objectives. There are some who argue in our country, many in other countries around the world, that the United States is fatally handicapped by a pro-Israel bias and therefore can't be a genuine neutral mediator. On the other side, when I was appointed to this position by the president, some in our country said, one guy actually said, Senator Mitchell is impeccably fair and honest, but those are not the qualities we need in this position. The truth is, the two objectives are not incompatible. They are complementary, as I said before. We can, and we must, be a fair arbiter to meet the dual objectives of protecting Israel's security, its existence as a Jewish state, and establishing a Palestinian state, a homeland for the Palestinian people. They will both be better off. We will be better off. And one reason we'll be better off is that the possibility of a conflict, which in that very volatile region, and especially at this turbulent time, could take dramatic courses that we can't now foresee. And that would be disastrous for us. Purely economic, look at it. For better or for worse, the economy of the United States and all of our major trading partners is heavily dependent on petroleum. And an outbreak of conflict in the region that threatened the supply of petroleum to the developed world would have catastrophic results on our economy. And if for that reason alone, if you leave aside morality, if you leave aside what you think of as military, national security, all of them have valid, but that alone tells us we really do have to be involved. We'd have to take the steps needed to prevent a spark from lighting a fire. And make no mistake about it, human history has seen many such sparks go in opposite direction. You can just look at the Arab Spring itself. A young Tunisian man, one man in one town in Tunisia, became frustrated, and he burned himself to death, and that touched off what has become an enormously significant revolution and what may be, in historic terms, one of the great revolutions, certainly, in the history of the Middle East. Now, obviously, the frustration was there. The anger and the fear and the hostility were there. This sparked it. That could happen in that region. And for that reason, we have to keep up our efforts. I'm asked, I'll answer the question before it's asked, am I optimistic? It's hard to be optimistic in the short term. But I believe that nations like individuals ultimately act out of self-interest. And I think, to me at least, the self-interest of the people of Israel and the self-interest of the Palestinian people is so clearly benefited by the creation of two states and an end of the conflict, that they will come to realize that and be prepared to act on it. It may not happen in the immediate future. I think it will occur, and I hope and pray that I will see it in my lifetime. Thank you all very much. It's been a great pleasure to be here. And,
so great content. Let me also say the senator has been very gracious. When I first reached out, I said I'd like to make this kind of the exclusive in the Portland area of talking about the subjects he's been talking about this evening. And he worked his schedule so we could do it, you know, earlier in October, not later, and then be kind of have the news out into the media or whatever. So he was very gracious doing that. I also said, would you mind if we invite up Selma Botman and have her, because of her background in the Middle East, also be part of the discussion? He said, absolutely. I showed him the 10 or 12 questions that we had gathered from some of you and said, do you want to change any of these? Do you want to delete any of these? He said, no, absolutely, I'll take all those on. So he's been very gracious in how he has responded to making this really a meaningful evening. Now, Selma's a little bit different, but I'd like to say that I've had the pleasure of introducing Selma to the business community. So she took over July of 2008. I invited her up because the chamber, the Portland Chamber, asked me to do a presentation on why Wright Express was so passionate about higher education. I thought, what better way to introduce Selma to the business community? And she upstaged me that day, got the key to the city. I sat down and got a crescent roll or something. But it was a great way for her to finally meet the business community. I know she's been out in the community. I was chair of the Board of Visitors for 2 years, so I really was working very closely with Selma. I know she's very strategic. I know she can make very bold moves. But I know fundamentally the one principle that she always is focused on is to make sure the things that she's doing at USM is student-focused and student-centric. And I think everybody can rally around that because it really is about the students at the end of the day. So I'm not going to read all of her bio. I think that says a lot about what she is all about in terms of what she's doing day in and day out to drive the agenda and the strategy at USM. But a little bit on what she has accomplished in her education and her background. She grew up outside of Boston, holds degrees in psychology from Brandeis University, in Middle East Studies from Oxford University, and a degree in Middle East Studies as well as a PhD in History and Middle Eastern Studies from Harvard University. She is a scholar of modern Middle East politics. Now, it was very clear this morning that she did not always agree with the senator, and I think that was great to have the feedback. This is a very complex and complicated situation, and there is no easy answers, and there are different perspectives. So I'm going to invite Selma up to say a few words, and then I'll ask a few questions and open it up to the audience for questions. Selma.
Thank you. We're really assembled here to hear the words of Senator Mitchell and his analysis of contemporary issues in the Middle East based on his substantial experience in the region. And we thank the senator for his profound insights in what he and Mike have talked about as a very complicated area of the world. Some of us might think that American interest in the Middle East is very recent, but in fact, it goes back to before the Second World War. At that time, in the aftermath of the Second World War, America became a profoundly important and dominant power, and indeed an important presence in the area. And from that time on, from the Second World War on, America has been directly or indirectly involved in the affairs of the region, beginning with the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, to Iran, to the Arab countries, Afghanistan, and beyond. America has been involved and associated with the shifting developments of the region and has been connected to the bumpy periods of change. Successive presidents have tried to conclude military, political, and economic arrangements. As the senator said, we have been involved and deeply concerned about oil production and the distribution of oil to the United States and across the world. Successive presidents have gallantly tried to broker peace accords between Israel and the Palestinians. And of course, we know that Senator Mitchell has been involved in many of these discussions. And he's brought extraordinary skills as a mediator and a negotiator and a fundamentally fair human being. As I look back over generations of Middle Eastern politics, next to the creation of the State of Israel, I find nothing of greater consequence or significance than the Arab Spring that erupted in 2010 and continues until this day. So I don't think it's an overstatement to conclude, even at this point in time, that the events that began in Tunisia, spread to Egypt, and right across the region have changed the Middle East forever. What was it about the Arab Spring that's so world historical? It was led by educated young people who were at the same time technologically skilled, fearless, and fed up with their condition. They toppled authoritarian leaders. They overturned repressive governments, and they're still active in the Middle East today. The revolution is based not on religion, but on a moral code that emphasizes human dignity, human rights, and justice. Not only are these ideas powerful and important, but they are articulated by young people who make up a disproportionate percentage of the population in the region. Their calls for democratic change, economic justice, jobs, fairness, citizenship are resonating with people who are rich, people who are poor, people who are urban, people who are rural. They're resonating with some elders as well. And as I am fond of saying, the genie has been let out of the bottle, and I don't think it'll be crammed back in. But lest we think that oppositional politics began in 2010, in fact, oppositional politics in the Middle East have a long pedigree. And throughout the 20th century, we can document the movements of Democrats, constitutionalists, trade unionists, leftists, feminists, and Islamists who have been agitating for change and advocating for the end of repressive governments. Whether they were battling foreign-dominated rulers, whether they were battling their own conservative monarchs or anti-democratic heads of state, oppositional forces did exist, and they did challenge their regimes. However, they were put down ruthlessly and forcefully and weren't able to have the kind of significant benefits that the young people have had in the recent past. So while each country in the Middle East has its own narrative and its own particular circumstances, the Arab Spring has raised a common demand for freedom, self-determination, and sovereignty. Calls for change have been dignified and universal. These young people who've been calling for the change have been bruised by their own governments and sometimes by foreign powers, and they are exerting a fundamental humanity. Sometimes they seem optimistic, sometimes they seem less so, but they are really making a case for a society where their voices can be heard. They will have a right to influence. They want to play a part in the political discourse in their own societies. They aspire to citizenship, something we in Western democracies often take for granted. So what have we learned from the Arab Spring? What have we learned from a half a century of conflict that has taken place? I think the most important thing to say is that we now understand that the so-called stability that existed under tyrannical Middle Eastern governments was simply illusory, and that beneath the surface of authoritarian rule seethed a fury that was waiting to explode. What is remarkable is that the fury erupted not in a blaze of violence, but rather as a moral revolution, and it only turns violent in self-defense. I think that we're all aware of the deep frustration that exists from Jordan to Libya, from Syria to Yemen, from Egypt to Bahrain, with echoes in Israel as well. People are calling for social, political, economic justice. And these calls are not Jewish or Muslim or Christian. They are universal. Everyone wants to live a life of decency, and everyone in this region deserves to do so. So we will watch intensely and hope fervently that no group is sidelined, and that right will win out within countries and across boundaries. It is only when grievances are first recognized that they can be resolved. And only when grievances are settled will the Middle East truly achieve stability and prosperity. Like the senator, I do not think this will be easy, quick, or without concessions. But as any good mediator will tell us, compromise is the art of dividing the cake in such a way that everyone believes he got the biggest piece. This is my hope for the Middle East as well. Thank you very much.
There's some good news. I had quite a few questions for the Senator in Selma this morning. He integrated that into his speech this evening, so some of those questions were answered. But let me just ask two questions of both of you, and then we'll open it up to the audience. So the first one, I had recently heard on the radio from a former Israeli foreign minister who said, "We are isolated," and the Senator talked a little bit about this. We have gone from 8 foreign Middle East embassies in Israel to 0. And that means they really are isolated, at least from the other Middle Eastern countries at this point. That says, does the U.S. lose its influence in the region because of the Palestinian and Israeli situation? So I think you've talked a little bit about that. But then the question is, what is the role of the Europeans and the rest of the world in resolving the problem? Do they still want us to lead?
Well, everyone would like to be a leader. That's true in every human society, including the Society of Nations. But I think there is a wide recognition that under the circumstances which exist today in the world and in the Middle East, the United States will have to play a leading role. Part of that is financial, which they all recognize. We universally regard the Camp David Agreement as a successful effort at peacemaking in the region. Israel and Egypt, who had fought previous wars, come together in the United States under the auspices of the president, and they enter into a peace treaty. Less often mentioned is that in order to keep the treaty in force, the United States promises to provide assistance to Israel of $3 billion a year and to Egypt of $2 billion a year for as long as they are at peace. Well, here we are 32 years later. They're still at peace, and we're still paying. That's a fact of life. Now, a lot of others would like to be leaders, but everybody recognizes that when Israel and the Palestinians make peace, it is going to be a very difficult and a very expensive proposition. And it couldn't possibly be done without the leadership and the resources of the United States. And in addition, I want to make one point, to emphasize one point that I alluded to. The United States is the dominant power in the world. And as such, it bears the burden that every dominant power in all of human history has borne: a certain degree of resentment, of envy, often the most intense resentment from those who are most in need of and receive the help. And that's a part of human nature as well. So we have a difficult task. At the same time, because of our ideals, the ideals to which I earlier alluded, there is a reservoir of goodwill in the world toward the United States, a yearning for thoughtful and effective American leadership, not dominance, leadership. And that exists in parts of the world that are ostensibly anti-American. We get our information now through televised images. And it's just a reality of life that televised images are the controversies. They are not representative of societies. To make a point, when I was Senate Majority Leader, we were working on a very big, important bill called the Clean Air Bill. It took us years to do it. And I can't tell you the number of issues, scientific, technical. We got about 90% of the way through. And the Washington Post wrote a huge story which was entirely devoted to the 10% of the disputes, and not one word about all the things that we'd done cooperatively. So I approached the reporter, and I said, yeah, this is really not fair. You guys print a story like this. It's kind of misleading. He said to me, Senator, you have never seen, and you never will see a headline that says, 2 million commuters made it safely to work today. You will see many headlines that say, 2 cars crashed and 6 people were killed. Controversy makes news. And so images are filtered that create misimpressions. You would think now that everybody in the world hates the United States. I travel all over the world. I don't think that's true. What they don't like is what they perceive to be the gap between our principles and our actions. They love our principles. They love our principles. And I used to tell this story when I traveled around in the Palestinian territories. They all kind of got a kick out of it. I'd say, you know, watching back home, every time you see a CNN camera, a bunch of guys run out with a can of gasoline and an American flag, and they burn it and demonstrate. But what I tell Americans is that if someone from the U.S. consulate came by and said, hey, guys, I got a bunch of visas here. Anybody like to go to the U.S.? They'd all drop the cans. They'd put the flags away, and they'd come grab the visas. And, of course, the audiences would all laugh. One guy usually would get up and say, no, I don't want to go. But the reality is there is a reservoir of goodwill. It has a long history. It has a long history. Many of the problems in the Middle East derive from the settlement at the end of the First World War in Versailles, where the British and French executed a secret deal to divide up the Middle East for themselves. Woodrow Wilson was the most popular American president ever outside the United States, because of his 14 principles, which people believed in and which he nor anyone could have delivered on. The British and the French took a lot of things into consideration in thinking about the Middle East. The only thing they didn't bother with is what the people, the Arabs themselves, thought. So Wilson sent a two-man commission to the Middle East to find out, what do the Arabs want? And they came back. Unfortunately, he was disabled while they were on their way back. The report didn't get much attention. What it said was they want two things. They want independence. What a surprise. And secondly, they want the United States here because that's the only country they trust that would help them get independence. Now, that's a long time ago, but to some degree, that's still the case. We got to do the best we can to live up to our principles. I said this earlier, so you mind if I repeat it, Selma? As individuals, every one of us wakes up each morning and we say, we're going to do better today. I'm not going to lie. I'm not even going to exaggerate once. I'm going to be nice to everybody. I'm not going to swear in front of my kids. I'm not going to cheat on my spouse. I got a whole long list of things I'm not going to do. And then each of us in some way fails every day. No human is perfect and no human institution is perfect. But we aspire to better things. And the United States is in the same boat. We aspire to better things. We fail often. We often are caught in circumstances which preclude the best choice. We have to make nasty compromises sometime because it's the better or the least bad way out. But people know when we really are trying to live up to our principles. And I believe that we do have influence, and we can lead, and we will lead, as long as we do it in a way that is consistent with our ideals.
I would only add that, and this goes back to the history, the post-World War I period, as the senator said, when European powers carved up the Middle East. England and France would like an increased role in the Middle East. But their checkered history gives people in the Middle East pause, and people remember the history of imperialism. They remember that France and Britain controlled many of the countries in the Middle East. And as a result, even though there is sometimes a love-hate relationship for the United States, America never colonized the Middle East. And this is an important point, I think, for those in the region. But I also want to go back to something the senator said with regard to Camp David. President Carter has become a controversial figure. But the most important legacy he leaves, I think, is the Camp David Accord. And the fact that he was able to bring together Yasser Arafat and Anwar Sadat and to conclude a peace that, Begin and Sadat, and conclude a peace that continues until this day, even though there are events that are making that peace complicated. I think that the legacy of President Carter is very important, and we should ask, what's different about the events today from the events in the late 1970s? What did President Carter have to work with that our contemporary presidents have not been do not have? And I would say that there was will. There was will in Egypt, and there was will in Israel to conclude this deal. It's not that Anwar Sadat had the support of his population. He amazed his population when he went to Jerusalem at the end of the 1970s. And he went to Jerusalem, arguably, for self-interested economic, military, and political reasons, not for high moral reasons. But nonetheless, President Carter was able to tap into a spirit of compromise and willingness. And that compromise I do not see evident in the contemporary leaders in the Middle East. And so that's why I think that the peace that people do long for and people need will be a long time off until we can find those leaders with moral authority to bring their populations with them or to announce that the survival of their people depends upon a compromise situation. But I do think that the United States will play the role of the honest broker, partly because we do not have a colonial past. Some people might argue that we practice economic colonialism. That's a very different argument than actually occupying a country and running it in the way Britain and France did. I mean, we are separating ourselves from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's taken a very long time for us to do that, but we are separating ourselves. So I do think that the United States will still have the authority to bring people together and to broker a peace if there's that kind of moral authority in the leaders in the region.
So we're getting close to 9 o'clock. I won't ask the other question. I'll see if there's a question from the audience. And if you're going to ask the question, to please introduce yourself. There are microphones.
Let's take the students if we can.
Okay. Or someone can hand the microphone.
Hi, I'm Julie Main. And I wanted to ask you about when the Palestinians were making their proposal for their own state, they suggested borders that included millions of Israeli citizens. And was there any plan put in place to deal with all those Israeli citizens if...
A plan to what?
To deal with all the Israeli citizens that would become part of the Palestinian state if the Palestinians had gotten their own state.
Well, that is, of course, one of the most controversial matters. The Israelis to whom you are referring, commonly referred to as settlers, live in areas that the Palestinians thought had been reserved for their state. The so-called settlements have been built since 1967, when Israel acquired that land as a consequence, control of that land as a result of its victory over Jordan and other Arab countries in the war. So it is contested. That is contested or disputed territory. And the Palestinian expectation is that the Israeli settlers will leave those lands and return to what will be Israel proper after such a settlement. It's complicated because there's more than one area and they have different statuses. There are, in certain areas, close to what everybody expects the border to be and close to Jerusalem, are very large concentrations of Israelis. And the words used are the 1967 line with agreed swaps. And the expectation of all concerned, Israelis and Palestinians, is that there will be a swapping of land so that those lands which have substantial and densely populated areas with Israelis will become part of Israel, in exchange for which Israel will transfer to Palestinians lands that are not now part of that area, so there'll be an exchange. That's an extremely controversial issue, but that's really the broadest outline of the issue.
And there is precedence for that, yeah, because the Israelis did move Israeli settlers from Sinai when Israel gave the Sinai back to Egypt. So there is precedence for that. But as the senator said, that's very controversial. And thank you for the question.
Right. So I know there's a lot of people there with questions. We were going to cut this at 9 o'clock, though. That was the plan. So I'll take one question over here, and I apologize to the rest in terms of not being able to take all the questions.
Senator Mitchell, I have a question regarding negotiating your partners. The political divisions on both sides appear to be becoming more and more divisive. How are you going, or how is the United States going to broker a deal? They've long argued that there was no good negotiating.
I can't really hear you, so they said speak directly to me, not into the mic.
The political divisions on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side seem to be becoming more and more divisive.
Right.
Who is the negotiating partner going to be? Who are you going to broker a deal with if there is nobody? I mean, if they said the Palestinians haven't put up a fair partner in post-2006.
Yeah.
They've had Abbas, who hasn't had the power he needs, and now it appears the same thing is happening on the Israeli side. I mean, are we just going to become a long-term caretaker?
Yeah. Well, we, of course, as has been discussed at great length this evening, believe in democracy and the right of self-determination. It is not our responsibility to choose for the people of Israel who their leaders will be, or to choose for the Palestinians who their leaders will be. Both of their leaders, Prime Minister Netanyahu for the Israelis and President Abbas for the Palestinians, were elected in what were judged to be free and fair and open elections. Israel is a very vibrant democratic society. There were about 30 parties that ran in that election. No party got anywhere near a majority, so the prime minister, as is common in parliamentary systems, put together a coalition of several parties, some of whom are very small single-issue parties that don't agree with the prime minister's policies in other respects. So it's a being Prime Minister of Israel is a very difficult job, and maintaining a coalition is a very difficult job. On the Palestinian side, Abbas was elected, and then in another democratic election, Hamas won control of the parliament. But that he's still the executive. It's like in 2004, President Bush was reelected. In 2006, Democrats gained control of the House, had control of the Senate, but nobody said Bush wouldn't be president anymore. He was still president for the last 2 years. He had a Democratic legislature. That was the situation in
on the Palestinian side. Now, his term expired. What Hamas has done has to say that he should not be representing the Palestinian people because his term has expired and he hasn't been reelected, which is a plausible argument until you realize that the reason he hasn't been elected is that they have refused to participate in an election or to permit an election to occur in Gaza, which they control. It's not particularly logical, but it has some traction among some people. But he's the elected leader. Right now, his popularity is the highest it's ever been because of the introduction of the resolution of statehood at the United Nations. The question is how long that will last. But I must say to you, on both sides, and particularly on the Palestinian side, it is very, very difficult for them to negotiate when they have such a divided society behind them. But I don't think we have any alternative but to deal with those persons who are chosen under the legal structures of those two societies as the ones to deal with. And so we deal with them. The real problem is getting them to deal with each other. That's the real problem. And to be candid, the mistrust is almost total. They just don't believe each other. They don't trust each other. So it's very hard to get them to a situation where there can be the kind of give and take that you need in a negotiation. And there is one other factor. It's not your question, but I'll make it because it's an important point to keep in mind in this conflict. One of the most powerful emotional and driving factors in conflict-divided societies is the profound sense of victimization that each side feels. Very true in Northern Ireland, very true in the Middle East. Each side can cite with great power and persuasive force a litany of wrongs that have been done to them over many years, not necessarily by the immediate other side, but by a whole range of other forces and factors. And when you have a profound sense of victimization, it generates the capacity for rationalizing your doing things that you might not otherwise do or think right. And both sides have, in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, have very deep senses of victimization and a profound sense of being entitled as a result of that history of victimization to take actions that they might not otherwise do or that others might not judge appropriate. But who are others to judge what we're doing given what we've been through? That's a universal experience in these conflict societies, conflict-driven societies. It's very, very hard to overcome. But in the end, and I'll repeat again what I said, people act out of self-interest. And I think societies act out of self-interest. And what they come to realize is that bad as it is to make a deal with these guys, painful as it is politically for me, fatal as it might be politically and personally, the alternative is worse. And that's, I think, how you end up getting people to move in these situations. But I confess it to be very, very difficult. I'll conclude by saying that I recently spoke to a very large gathering of Irish Americans, and I told them that I never thought the day would come when I would believe or say what I now believe and say, that the Irish were really easy to deal with.
So I do apologize. I know people have questions, but yeah, we are past 9 o'clock. So I'd like to thank the senator for this evening and for all the insight, and also to Selma, President Botman. This has been a great evening. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, former Special Envoy for Middle East Peace under President Barack Obama. Mitchell was also joined by USM President and Middle East scholar Selma Botman. Mitchell recently spoke at the annual Right Express Leadership and Creativity Series at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. You can listen to this program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.